Today is May the 29th, 2019. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, and Amazon are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm, on the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday, 6 p.m., the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave us a message with your question or comment to Hank at pcradioshow.org. You can also reach us on the Google number 862-800-6805. That's 862-800-6805. Start your message with The Personal Computer Show, followed by your message. Hackers have been holding the city's Baltimore computers hostage. Hackers have targeted the city of Baltimore on May 7th using a ransomware called Robinhood, which makes it impossible to access a server without a digital key that only the hackers have. The Baltimore hackers' ransom note, obtained by the Baltimore Sun, demanded payment of 3 bitcoins per system to be unlocked, which amounts to 13 bitcoins to unlock all seized systems. The note threatened to increase the ransom if it wasn't paid in 4 days and said the information would be lost forever if it wasn't paid in 10 days. Both deadlines have since passed. The city government is refusing to pay, meaning that the government email systems and payment platforms the attack took down remain offline. The attack has also harmed Baltimore's property market because officials were unable to access systems needed to complete real estate sales. Baltimore Mayor Jack Young, who's officially been in his office less than a month, said in a statement on Friday that city officials are well into the restorative process and have engaged leading industry cybersecurity experts who are on site 24/7 working with us. The FBI is also involved in the investigation. Some of the restoration efforts also require that we rebuild certain systems to make sure that when we restore business functions, we are doing so in a secure manner. He did not offer a timeline for when all systems will come back online. The Baltimore City Council president also plans to form a special committee to investigate this latest attack and try to ensure it doesn't happen again. A similar attack using Robinhood hit government computers in Greenville, North Carolina, in April. A spokesperson for Greenville told the Wall Street Journal that the city never wound up paying and that while systems aren't entirely restored, all our major technology needs are now being met. More than 20 municipalities in the United States have been hit by cyber attacks this year alone, and such attacks can be expensive, perhaps especially if targets say they won't pay. In 2018, hackers demanded that Atlanta pay about $50,000 in bitcoins as part of a ransom attack. The city refused, and according to a report obtained by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and Channel 2 Action News, the attack wound up costing the city $17 million a fix. Ransomware attacks aren't new, but we're still figuring out how to deal with them. In 2017, a ransomware called WannaCry targeted tens of thousands of computers using Microsoft Windows operating systems in more than 100 countries. Officials in the United States and the United Kingdom eventually blamed North Korea for the attack. Also in 2017, corporations in the United Kingdom, France, Russia, Israel, and Ukraine experienced ransomware attacks. U.S. hospitals were also targeted. The basic idea behind ransomware is simple. A criminal hacks into your computer, scrambles your files with unbreakable encryption, and then demands that you pay for the encryption key needed to unscramble the files. If you have important files on your computer, you might be willing to pay a lot to avoid losing them. Ransomware schemes have become a lot more effective since the invention of Bitcoin in 2009. Conventional payment networks like Visa and MasterCard makes it difficult to accept payments without revealing your identity. Bitcoin makes that a lot easier, So the past 4 years, you have seen surge in ransomware schemes striking unsuspecting PC users. Some ransomware schemes are so sophisticated, they even invest in customer service, helping victims who want to pay their ransoms navigate the complexities of obtaining bitcoins and making bitcoin payments. Since then, a number of sectors and organizations have made improvements to their security practices to protect against ransomware. But the latest Baltimore attack exemplifies what a whack-a-mole game this is. One area improves its practices, and hackers just go looking for another. When 9/11 hit the financial institutions, they were able to activate their contingency of a backup site for processing and restoring data from backup files within days. You don't pay ransom, for there's no guarantee that hackers will hold their end of the bargain if a victim pays. If the systems were restored, what is the integrity of data that had not been altered? Didn't these municipal systems have a contingency backup plan? There was a survey by the Junior Achievement Organization, and they had asked teens about career and job goals. A new survey by Junior Achievement, conducted by the research group Engine, shows that only 9% of girls between ages 13 and 17 are interested in careers in STEM, which stands for science, technology, engineering, and math. This is down from 11% from a similar survey last year. Teen boys' interest in STEM careers increased slightly to 27%, up from 24% last year. The survey was conducted from April 16th to the 21st of this year. The decline of interest in STEM careers is disappointing, given how much emphasis is being placed on promoting STEM to girls, the president and CEO of Junior Achievement said. One element that may need to be emphasized more is ensuring that STEM professionals are serving as role models and working with girls in educational settings as part of these initiatives. A 2009 study from MIT indicates that young people are interested in STEM at an early age, but begin to lose interest as they become older due to lack of interaction with mentors and role models in the STEM fields. A way Junior Achievement is addressing this is by bringing in STEM professionals into classrooms to deliver the organization's career readiness program. Other findings from the survey include the following. 85% of teens says they know what kind of job they want after graduation, down slightly from 88% in 2018. While girls' interest in STEM careers like engineering, robotics, and computer science decline, their interest in careers in the medical and dental fields increased by 25%, up from 19% in 2018. Half of all teens, that's 51%, expect to work this summer. However, more than two-thirds of the 16 and 17-year-olds, that's 69%, expect to have a summer job. Top summer jobs include retail, 26%, food services, 26%. These are followed by outdoor work, 17%, and babysitting and childcare, 14%. Very few, 5%, anticipate working in an office over the summer. Junior Achievement delivers programs focused on promoting work readiness, entrepreneurship, and financial literacy to students in grades K through 12. Junior Achievement programs help teens better understand the connection between what they learn in school and how it will apply toward their future careers. In 2018, Junior Achievement of New York reached 90,000 students across the five boroughs of New York City, as well as Long Island and Lower Hudson Valley. Recently, there's been a lot of talk about the gig economy. Well, we know what it is. We know what the top jobs are in the gig economy, but is it for everyone, and is it something that should be taken seriously? And in a recent study, the statistics are quite surprising. The gig economy proves that independent contract work is much more than something to do between jobs. And for many, it can be a full-time career. Freelancers, independent consultants, whatever you call them, the rise of the gig economy has been a major force to be taken seriously. Freelancing often is regarded as something to do between full-time jobs. Now, nearly 55 million Americans are working in micro-businesses or freelancing. That's 35% of the U.S. workforce alone. Research has uncovered some key realities for gig workers last year. Freelancing is a viable, sustainable career path, according to a survey that 5 out of 6 freelancers reach their income goals within 2 years of starting. The 42% who reached their goals within 12 months were twice as likely to earn more than $75,000 per year. Some 54% report they are saving for the future, and 60% have life insurance. Both figures bode well for an economy that is increasingly reliant on freelancers, since contract workers don't receive corporation-sponsored benefits. As more businesses rely on outsourced skilled talent, this demand for flexible expertise means freelancing opportunities will continue to grow. Freelancers are committed to growth. The majority of freelancers are in this for the long term. 54% have no desire to go back to full-time work, although better income is the biggest temptation to do so. They also take marketing themselves seriously, saying it's important or very important for their business. They spend up to $100 each month on marketing initiatives, but a little more than half of them think marketing is too time-consuming, and 41% also say it's too expensive. The majority, a surprising 86%, do it completely on their own. And here's the rub, though. Those who spend more than $100 per month on their marketing earn significantly more than their less promotionally minded colleagues. Seasoned freelancers are a happy lot. While millennials have broken ground by using social media marketing to launch their career, they aren't the first generation to embrace freelancing. Older freelancers, those age 35 and older, are far less likely to return to full-time employment than their younger peers, and 57% are satisfied with the work-life balance that freelancing brings. Another interesting finding examines how respondents choose to label themselves. This says a great deal about their self-image and the career paths they envision. Half of the respondents identified as self-employed. 19% call themselves small business owners, and another 19% identify as entrepreneurs, and 12% favor the term freelancers. No matter what you call it, this type of work is thriving. In the United States, and an estimated 3.2 million full-time independent contractors claim an annual income of more than $100,000 a year. Another 12.9 million are working as part-time freelancers. The population generally reports that independent work and the independent lifestyle is a satisfying way of building income and obtaining greater freedom, control, and purpose. The very structure of work in America is evolving, and the demand for skilled independent workers will only increase as companies look to become more agile and flexible in the future. So, what is the average annual income for a freelancer in the United States? In late October, Upwork and Freelancers Union released their annual report, a comprehensive look at the independent U.S. workforce. The results of their 5th annual report were encouraging, and here were their key findings. More than 1 in 3, 35%, American freelance in 2018, amounting to 56.7 million independent employees. The freelance market grew 7% from 2017 compared to a non-freelance market, which rose 2%. More than half, that's 51%, of freelancers says no amount of money would get them to take a traditional job. While it's true that freelance rates can vary drastically depending on the industry and the type of work, whether you are a full-timer or you're freelance as a side hustle. That said, a separate study by Payoneer found that the average freelancer in the U.S. earns $31 an hour compared to $26.30 an hour for all American employees in 2017. Freelance rates can be much higher than the national average depending on the discipline you choose. Freelancers in the United States make an average of $31 an hour, which comes out to 17% more than a typical full-time employed worker, according to the survey. In a poll of about 1,000 freelancers in a range of finance, tech, and creative roles, and found that the population of gig workers in the United States is a well-paid one, pretty much across the board. In the United States, the average freelance rate outpaces a traditional 9-to-5 by a long shot. As of October 2017, Median weekly earnings for a full-time U.S. worker was just shy of $45,000 a year, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. For freelancers, $31 an hour works out to about $64,000 a year. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell on his IT Pro Series, Exploring Types of Servers.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and I'm here to give you some benefit from my experience of being an IT professional of many, many years. This week, I want to kind of give you an idea of servers. And now you may have heard this kind of analogy, this kind of discussion before about how computers are everywhere in our lives. Servers are actually everywhere in our lives. We aren't always aware that all of these servers exist, but they do exist. They do provide us many things. And we think of all of the different areas where computers or computer chips exist. Servers exist almost as much. As a matter of fact, I'm going to start off with a basic item that is your desktop, your laptop. It actually may be able to serve as a server. It may be serving as a server already. Do you have your desktop hooked up to a printer and everybody in the house actually prints through your computer to that printer? Well, then your system, your desktop, is a server. A server is just a system that is providing information or services to other computers. It's providing a way for some other computer to do something. So we start off with the basic, the very simplest of servers, a file and print server. So if you're sharing information on your computer, you're actually working it as a server. If you're sharing a printer, it's actually working as, yes, a server. So a home server, a dedicated home server, a little bit step up from where your personal system is serving as a server. A home server can sit there and it can do a number of different things. It serves as a centralized location for all of the computers to put files there, and it stays up dedicated to that purpose. Maybe has printers set up, maybe has the printer drivers installed there, even though the printer is a network printer, not actually physically hooked up other than through the network connections. This is just another step beyond your desktop serving as a server. Now, let's go that next step up. So many of the home servers are very basic, very simple. They don't do a lot of security. They don't do a lot of interaction. They don't really share a whole lot of information. You can't just put another one next to it and then just type in a few words and all of a sudden they're talking to each other and they're sharing and working together to provide you with a unified experience. That turns into more of that small business experience. And then when we move into the business world, we start talking about Windows Server 2016, 2012, 2008. You might have heard these numbers along the way. And that's just servers, and they're dedicated, and they may be serving up information to a number of people throughout your organization, or even sometimes external to the organization. As companies get larger, they may bring a web server in-house. It's just another physical device that is sitting there and it's operating and it's providing information to anybody who requests it, so long as they have authentication or they have the rights to access it. Another type of server from there is a mail server. As a matter of fact, we access mail servers on a regular basis. When you're downloading your email, you're accessing a mail server. Hopefully that mail server is secured. It's locked down and nobody else can get to it, but it's still a server and it's still being used by you. Now, let's move on to something a little bit more advanced. That's just mail. It's just text, maybe a few pictures, and it's only sitting there waiting for you to request the mail. What about an application server? What is an application server? Well, that's where the server sits there, and it's actually starting to do some processing, more than just receiving mail and filing through it and sending it to the right people and protecting you utilizing antivirus software. It may be providing an entire chunk of computing power operating between database servers. I'll get there in a moment. And the users, it's providing an application. Much like you start up Microsoft Word, this application server is doing a lot of thinking. We frequently see this kind of thing in more of a small enterprise to larger enterprise software packages, like an ERP software, enterprise resource planning software. And that ERP software runs the entire company. Now, some of the different things that you put into that application server wind up being stored or reutilized through your interaction. But then when you're not connected, it also does a lot more thinking, a lot more processing, and it works with the database. The database server, as we were also mentioning, is where a lot of information is stored. It's stored in a database, but now it can serve as a database for a lot of different people. Additionally, we can have that database do a lot of just database processing, sorting of information, putting out automatic reporting, doing a number of different things, much like an application server. So when we boil this all down, all of these different servers are operating very similarly to each other. They're doing slightly different things in slightly different ways. But what brings them all together is that one name. They're all operating as a server, providing an application or service to you. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. What do you do when your computer seems to be running with a mind of its own? There are apps when installed that refuses to be uninstalled. There are instances when your Windows operating system appears to be running out of control. You run the registry cleaner. You clean up extraneous files with Crap Cleaner or CCleaner. It didn't help at all. Your first step is to do a system restore to a date prior to the date of the problem. If you did not have the saving the system restore point set on, well, then you've had a teachable lesson. In most cases, it does solve the problem. But what if that doesn't fix the problem? What's next? You go to Plan B. Use the system file checker tool that's built into Windows to repair missing or corrupted system files. If some Windows functions aren't working or Windows crashes, use the system file checker to scan Windows and restore your files. How do you do it? Well, get into command mode in administrative mode and then run system file checker, that's SFC. That's SFC space / scan now. I'll repeat that again. SFC space / scan now, and then you press enter. This will take a while to run. Just be patient. Go out and have a mug of coffee. Wait a minute, change that to a carafe full of coffee. I've run SFC on computers and it either returns a report of no problems or it reports it has found problems and fixed them. In rare cases, it does report corruption found and not able to do a fix. When that happens, you go to Plan C. Microsoft has a fix-it utility. Just do a search in the URL typing the following: Microsoft space fix space it space tool. I'll repeat it again. It's Microsoft fix it tool. If you're not on the computer that has the problem, just save the troubleshooter to a flash drive and then run it on the computer that has the problem. What does this fix? Corrupted registry keys on a 64-bit operating system. Corrupted register keys that control the update data. Problems that prevent new programs from being installed. Problems that prevent existing programs from being completely uninstalled or updated. Problems that block you from uninstalling a program through add or remove programs, or Programs and Features in the Control Panel. If the problem persists, then go to Plan D, which is to rebuild the operating system. By the way, you did do backup on your data on a regular basis, right? Let's say you need to reinstall the Windows operating system. When you purchase a system today, the distribution version of the operating system is stored in hidden partitions. If it was a Windows 10 operating system on the computer, a factory reset will get you back to the release version of Windows 10 at the time of purchase. After the reinstallation over time, your computer will be upgraded to the latest version of Windows 10. You will need only to reinstall the applications originally on the system with the associated data from your backup files. But what if the factory reset gets you back to Windows 7, which you had subsequently upgraded to Windows 10? The free upgrade of Windows 7 to 10 from Microsoft terminated at the end of 2016. There were Microsoft Windows build releases, version 1507, 1511, and 1607 prior to the beginning of 2017. If you have downloaded any one of those releases, you can still do a free upgrade of Windows 7 to Windows 10. These Windows 10 build versions are still available from Microsoft, but at a price. They are available from third-party sources, free. One site is windowsiso.net. That's windowsiso.net. Even if you don't need it today, but the hidden partitions is Windows 7, download the appropriate build release before Microsoft formally requests third-party sites to cease distribution. The downloaded file is in ISO or image format. When you open the ISO file in Windows 10, you have opened a subdirectory of all the files in the Windows 10 distribution. Copy these files onto a USB drive and run the setup.exe to upgrade your Windows 7 to 10. You can run a clean install instead of the upgrade if you have the Windows 7 product code. What if you had mislaid the product 7 product code? What do you do then? And you don't have it readily available. Simple. Download the program Magical Jelly Bean, and when you run that program, it will tell you what the product code is, but do this before you begin any upgrade or reinstallation of Windows 10. Preventive hardware maintenance of computing equipment. We've been inoculated in the media about the importance of what we eat and drink. The food we ingest has a direct effect on our physical health. Similarly, the care and preventive maintenance of the computing hardware we use will operate more efficiently and we will be able to lengthen the product life cycle of the hardware. With personal computing, there is the hardware maintenance and the software maintenance of a computer system. Preventive maintenance refers to regular, routine maintenance to help keep equipment up and running, preventing any unplanned downtime and expensive costs from unanticipated equipment failure. Include hardware preventive maintenance as a procedure whenever you change the clock in the spring from standard time to daylight time, and in the fall from daylight time to standard time. Computers these days are so reliable in general that we pretty much just ignore the question of whether the surrounding environment is one in which the computer can and should operate. Especially when talking about an office environment, we usually just assume that if we're okay to be in the room, then the computer is probably fine as well. That's not a terrible assumption to start with, but there are some exceptions. If you want your equipment to last a long time and perform well, then taking environmental factors into consideration is actually something you should do. The hardware maintenance of the equipment is to run the system CPU within the range specified by the manufacturer. In general, the internal elements of the CPU has an outer operating limit of 35 to 80 degrees Celsius or 95 to 176 degrees Fahrenheit. What's the best CPU temperature? Don't let your CPU run too hot. The CPU is the processor inside your computer that's responsible for most of the day-to-day number crunching. In short, it's the part that does most of the work to make Windows and applications run. You should consider the operating range of 45 to 70 degrees Celsius or 113 to 158 degrees Fahrenheit, the absolute minimum and maximum for long periods of operation. When it senses the extreme temperatures, the CPU will shut down to prevent any damage. This is temperature operating inside the CPU and not outside of the CPU casing. You have other electronics that are affected by temperature extremes, such as memory. Back in the 1980s, when I operated a bulletin board network, I located the equipment in a spare room where there was no heat or air conditioning. The system froze up when the room temperature dropped below 40 degrees Fahrenheit. Most people will not have to worry about cold temperatures when operating the computer, but heat is a common problem in the operation of a computer system. Before the CPU shuts down, it will run slower and slower and slower. You may wonder why, when you are running the system in a room that is comfortable in temperature, that this can happen. The fan dispersing the heat inside the system unit may not be functioning properly. Most users do not realize dust builds up inside a desktop system unit as well as inside a notebook. Some are running tower systems. To not clutter desktop space, many opt to place the unit at floor level. This placement attracts more dust at this level than the desktop. Another factor are those who have pets at home. Pet hair accumulation around the fan will cause the fan to rotate at a much lower RPM and in effect not be able to cool the CPU unit. Use a vacuum carefully to suck out dirt and debris or blow out the dust with a can of compressed air. If you're using compressed air, try not to blow the dust back inside the system unit. If you are able to open the desktop system unit or open the notebook to access the inside, the dust cleaning would be a simple task. The placement of a system unit should have spacing where the fan can blow out. Backing it against the wall would inhibit the fan to be effective. With desktop units, you also have connecting cables. Make sure they are not bent to a point where it's not making good contact with the connecting ports. The ideal temperature is as cool as possible, which usually means room temperature. Since a hot running CPU could cause problems ranging from unwanted system crashes to physical damage to the process itself, you can keep it cool by controlling fan speeds. Another item you should check periodically is a surge protector. The surge protector protects against sudden electrical spikes. When it happens, it will render the surge protector to be useless unless the surge protector can be reset. If you see the light blinking on a surge protector, it means it's time for replacement or you need to do a reset on the surge protector. If you live in a city like New York where there is rolling brownouts during the summer to prevent a total power shutdown, it is recommended you connect your equipment to a UPS battery backup unit. Prices have fallen sharply for this equipment. Units are available for less than $40, which is not that much more than a surge protector with reset feature. A brownout is an intentional or unintentional drop in voltage in an electrical power supply system. Intentional brownouts are used for load reduction in emergency. The reductions last for minutes or hours. The irregular power supply during the brownout can ruin your computer and other electronic devices. Electronics are created to operate at specific voltages, so any fluctuations in power, both up and down, can damage them. A UPS with voltage regulation can prevent any damage to equipment. Most modern CPUs, including AMD, have a protection feature that automatically shuts them down if they get too hot, so that actual damage is unlikely. You can check the specifications of your particular CPU, which details the maximum operating temperatures for many processors. How does one check CPU temperature? Download the program HWinfo by doing a search using the following syntax: download space HWinfo. That's download space HWinfo. This program is free and it does very detailed hardware monitoring. It will monitor CPU temperature, speed of the fan, and the life of the battery in the notebook. Temperature is very easy to dismiss because most of us don't think about it when it comes to computers. We just assume it doesn't matter when in fact it does. As long as you know when and when not to operate a computer based on temperature, you should be, well, A-OK. Also bear in mind that all computer hardware and laptops has specifications that state minimum and maximum operating temperatures, and they're usually 100% accurate, and it needs to be observed. What do you do when your system can't start up cleanly or just doesn't turn on? Last Wednesday, I had finished editing the weekly broadcast at about 2 a.m. in the morning, and there was a message that Windows Update would start up. I opted to let the Windows Update proceed as I was tired. I did not back up the completed broadcast. I just went to sleep. I woke up at about 8 a.m. and got back onto the system. The system booted up asking for the Windows password. I had none to begin with. Only option was entering the password or click on I forgot password. Each time I clicked on I forgot password, I received a message to enter password or click on I forgot password. Each time I turned off the machine and restarted, the same message popped up on the screen. I went into action on Plan A to get the system up and running. I tried booting up with warm restart on a number of occasions to no avail, and now it was time to go into Plan B. I pulled out the Windows installation distribution to do an initial system boot, and I selected the Windows System Restore option. There were about 9 different points of options available for me to use. I went through each restore attempt, and it failed. I wasn't flustered yet. I just moved on to Plan C. Next option was to restore to the previous build. Unfortunately, the previous build was corrupted. Well, I next tried to do a factory reset without losing data. Murphy's Law was in effect. It was not possible to do a clean system install without erasing the data. I had just spent 3 hours trying to retrieve the data, and the clock was ticking. So, rather than spend any more time on it, I called Microsoft support. The technician suggested all the steps I had gone through. His final recommendation was just do a factory reset, forget about any data being available. According to him, there was no other option. But in the back of my mind, I always had a last resort. I removed the hard disk drive from the notebook in question and installed the hard drive into an external enclosure. This in turn was connected to another system I had available. This enabled me to recover last week's broadcast. When you are removing any component part from a notebook, just remember to disconnect the AC power and remove the battery from the unit first. What lessons were to be learned? Well, turn off the automatic Windows update and do the manual update, and don't feel bad that you're not doing an update immediately as soon as it's released. In fact, I would hold off until there's no other complaints on it. There had been a lot of complaints about the Windows 10 update, release 18.07. Make sure your system restore for the drive C is on, because that's where your operating system is. And in my case, I had on hand a spare external enclosure, and if you don't have one, you can get one for about $10 at Micro Center so that you can move the hard or solid-state drive into that enclosure. Also have available a Windows 10 distribution media available. If you don't have it, there is a website you can go to. It's called windowsiso.net. That's one word, windowsiso.net. They have many of the 7, 8, 8.1, and 10 distributions of Windows available. In my case, for Windows 10, I keep the releases that were in 2015 and 2016. I don't necessarily have to worry about keeping up to date on 17 and 18. Reasons are very simple. If you install Windows from 2015 or 2016, it would do a free upgrade of 7 or 8.1 to Windows 10. If you use the later ones, it won't. Download the hardware maintenance manual so you know how to open up the unit to remove the hard disk drive. If you do not or are unable to get a clean boot, try restore to a prior system restore point that was working. If unsuccessful, try all other restore points. If that is unsuccessful, then restore to a prior build. If that is unsuccessful, well, you know the drill. We tell listeners that not all information on the internet is accurate. For me, if there's any question about a news item or statement, I try to get it verified from more than one source. But what do you do when there's a conflict of information with a research study in which two U.S. government agencies are at odds with each other? One says there's a clear cell phone cancer link, and that is based on a recent study by the National Toxicology Program under the National Institute of Health, showing clear evidence, at least what they say, of a causal link between cancer and exposure to wireless cell phone signals. These are results from a $30 million NTP study demonstrating that cell phone radiation caused Schwann cells cancers of the heart and brain, gliomas in rats, as well as DNA damaged in the brain. That's big news. In the National Institute of Health news release, NTP senior scientists said, "We believe that the link between radio frequency radiation and tumors in male rats is real, and the external experts agree." But amazingly, the FDA, which is the Food and Drug Administration, says it disagrees with this carefully conducted peer review study finding of clear evidence of really ill effects. According to the director of the FDA Center for Devices and Radiological Health, these findings should not be applied to human cell phone usage. They add that we believe the existing safety limits for cell phones remain acceptable for protecting the public health. While expressing this opinion, Dr. Shuren of the FDA neglects to note that the International Agency for Research Center on Cancer, a part of the World Health Organization, classifies radio frequency radiation from wireless devices as a possible human carcinogen based largely on findings of increased risk of gliomas and Schwann cell tumors in the brain near the ear in humans after long-term use of cell phones. Thus, the same tumor types are elevated in both animals and humans are exposed to cell phone radiation. The FDA's position is quite unusual because it was this agency that nominated cell phone radiation emitted from wireless communication devices to the NTP for studies in experimental animals so as to provide the basis to assess the risk to human health. At that time, the FDA reasoned that existing exposure guidelines are based on protection from acute injury from thermal effects of radio frequency radiation exposure and may not be protective against any non-thermal effects of chronic exposure. By adopting this new position and ignoring the NTP's results, the FDA is clearly shirking its responsibility of assessing the impact on human health of radio frequency radiation. Simply claiming that conclusions about human risk cannot be drawn from animal studies runs counter to standard practices of evaluating human cancer risk by public health agencies. The NTP studies were conducted to test a widely held assumption that cell phone radio frequency radiation could not cause cancer or other adverse health effects because this type of radiation did not have sufficient energy to break chemical bonds. The NTP findings that cell phone radiation caused cancer in the heart and brain, DNA damage in brain cell, heart muscle disease, and reduced birth weights clearly demonstrate that the assumption that non-ionizing radiation cannot cause cancer or other health effects is wrong. This study by the National Health Institute runs counter to the Food and Drug Administration, and what does the public do when there is a difference in the findings or interpretation or an analysis of the information itself? For me, I would probably say I would err on the safety side and say, yes, there may be a potential problem with radio frequency radiation, and I would be more careful in the use of cell phones to make sure that it is not placed close to the ear. An important lesson that should be learned from the NTP studies is that we can no longer assume that any current or future wireless technology, including 5G, is safe without adequate testing. Presenting Marty Winston on his shooting pains. Actually, he's building in his home a little TV studio for recording, and he's got a lot of painful things to do.
Well, I've been around TV studios since the 1960s. Back then, the mantra was, "You're on when you're on, you've got what you've got, so use that to keep the audience interested until the clock says 30. Those were 30-minute shows. Later, I wrote, produced, and directed TV commercials that ran between 10 and 60 seconds. Most were 30 seconds long. Right now, I'm folding TV production back into my weekly work, shooting segments for two weekly series, each just 1 minute long. I'm not talking YouTube. These are for air. If you had to do that today, what equipment would you be using? My main cameras are a pound of butter size HD camcorder and the video mode on my Nikon D3300. If I were only shooting with those, I could do a decent job of weaving together clips into the weekly segments. But I know from my making commercials days that viewers expect more variety. So I also have a marvelous Aphidus ATL200 from timelapsecameras.com. It's a marvelous and simple HD camera that can shoot time-lapse videos in a wide gamut of configurable ways. It's kind of shooting life in fast forward. I have 3 drones with HD or better cameras that can add dramatic angles and moves when I'm outdoors. I have a borescope camera that can shoot inside walls. I have a thermal camera. I have an RF backscatter imager, though I'm not entirely sure where that might fit in. My Nikon is on a really cool new Shotoku SD20 system tripod, and there's something I can do with it that solves a big challenge. Here's the challenge. My walls are framed but unfinished, and the ceiling won't be finished for probably another month, maybe longer, but my shots shouldn't make that obvious. When I extend the Shotoku tripod so that it puts the Nikon lens at the same height off the floor as my eyeballs when I'm standing, I can angle the lens to keep the ceiling out of the frame. That's a huge help. Lighting is another challenge, but happily, it's a challenge that today's LED fixture products, they make its solution well within reach. One huge difference is that light sources at the heart of these fixtures are not collectively the single points of light of traditional Klieg lights and spotlights and studio lights. They're all spread out and very nicely diffused, meaning a lot less of a hassle with shadows. Also, I'm working with cameras with a wide dynamic range. You'll see the letters WDR on their product pages. It just means that they can get decent pictures out of brighter or dimmer lighting than traditional cameras. That, too, simplifies my lighting challenges. Another thing that helps is that I'm not just doing 60 continuous seconds of talking head or stand-and-pitch delivery. Few single shots are more than 5 to 10 seconds. Many are just a second or two, some even shorter. I can cut away to close-ups, or to action shots, or to new viewpoints, or to shots from different kinds of imagers. That idea of alternative images also, in its own way, applies to the audio. When I'm off-camera, the same professional quality Audio-Technica condenser mic that I use to record these segments is the mic I use. When I'm on-camera, I'm wearing a wired or wireless lavalier microphone. In the field, I have some handheld audio recorders I can use. My main video cameras are also recording audio, and I always have the option of mixing in those tracks. Overall, lots of mics and lots of choices, but there's one special kind of mic that I should also mention. It's called a boundary mic. It usually goes on a tabletop or a floor, and it's engineered so that it doesn't pick up echoes from the surface that it's on. It tends to hear pretty much everything a human ear can hear, meaning a lot of ambient environment noise like footsteps or fan noise or rain on the window. So this isn't a mic for announcing, but it's a great mic when you want to present the kind of sound that says, this isn't fake, you're really there. So it's especially effective for demos. During my life, I've spent thousands of hours in audio recording studios, radio studios, and TV studios. The production approaches taken in those places are sensible for what they have to do. Multiple cameras working at once, multiple mics working at once, and a director to decide which images and sounds will be the ones that get presented, largely as real-time decisions. I'm a one-man shop, so I'm taking a different approach. If you've ever played with Legos, that's a pretty good metaphor. I have lots of different kinds of assets. Of course, videos that I've shot, video clips, maybe some stills, audio tracks, an underlying music bed, and an idea of the story I want to tell. I'll write myself a script for setup and for linking moments, record on mic the parts where I don't have to be on camera, and shoot the bits of video when I do. As I fiddle with these assets, I think about places where captions may help, and I lay those in. Do I like what I see? Sometimes. Or sometimes I may start over. When I'm doing radio, just audio, I tend to use Audacity as my editor. When I'm doing video, I've been using for decades Vegas Pro, but I'm also looking forward to trying the newer Vegas Movie Studio 16 suite. It looks promising. It may simplify a lot of things that, challenge me. I mean, listen, when you finish a rack of barbecue ribs, you can't exactly send the bones back to the kitchen and say, here, make me a new pig. If you want a pig, it takes more than a few pieces of skeleton to make it happen. Producing for TV or radio is like that, too. My challenge is to turn what's essentially show and tell into storytelling, and to make it interesting, and to keep it interesting. That's why I keep so many different kinds of cameras around, to present the most interesting image I can muster. It's why I use a variety of mics and snag audio from more than just my moving lips. You may have heard the calls, sound, lights, camera, action. It takes all that to get a scene rolling. Next time, you won't be rolling around on the floor, but you will learn about Rigid Core LVT, just about the most trouble-free and durable flooring ever. I sat down with experts, and I'll have a lot to share.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. It's a HamFest. HamFest 2019, which will be held Sunday, June 2nd, from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m., and it'll be held at the New York Hall of Science. That's out in Queens. Take the number 7 Flushing train and get off at 111th Street. It's one stop before Metz Field, Willets Point. Admission is $5 and free for children under 12 years of age. The following are computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. All these computer club meetings are open free to the public. Danbury Area Computer Society has a meeting on Tuesday, June the 4th. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m., and it will be held at Danbury Hackerspace, 158 Main Street, Danbury, Connecticut. Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on ADA's driverless cars, Thursday, June the 6th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road in White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has their meeting on Friday, June 7th. Meeting time is 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue, in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The Computer Learning Center at Ewing has a presentation on Apple Seeds and Apple devices, Tuesday, June 11th. Meeting time is 2 p.m., and it's held at the Ewing Senior and Community Center, 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. The Kingsbyte Computer Club meets Tuesday, June the 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Park Plaza Restaurant, 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn, New York. New York Amateur Computer Club has their general meeting on Thursday, June the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at NYU Silver Building at 32 Waverly Place in Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group has a meeting on Friday, June the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., at the Harry J. Scherr Hall, New York Institute of Technology, out in Old Westbury Campus, Old Westbury, New York. Princeton PC Users Group has a meeting on Tuesday, June the 25th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. And Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, June the 27th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet in the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room, 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. If you have a computer club meeting you want me to announce on the air, send me a note. My address is hank@pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, on PRN.FM, on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on PRN.FM on the internet and PCRadioshow.org. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@PCRadioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.